Well, let's get started, shall we?
It being 9:35, and
after a man, one of the gentlemen who taught me to trap beaver 40 years ago.
Isn't that right?
Going to.
It's the guy from NERF.
Well, let's ask him to sit over here.
Kim Garchuk.
Okay.
I think the university's tied into that.
Oh, I like that title.
Well, would Daley Sambo please take her place? Well, ladies and gentlemen, to open the proceedings this morning, I will introduce myself. I am Tom Berger, conducting the Alaska Native Review Commission, which has been established by the Inuit Circumpolar Conference to review the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. The commission is co-sponsored by the World Council of Indigenous People. The main part of the Commission's work will be to hold meetings in villages throughout Alaska so that Alaska Natives, Eskimo, Indian, and Aleut can express their views regarding the impact of the Claims Act, the ways in which it has worked out well, the ways in which it may not have worked out well, the position today in their villages, their views regarding the corporate arrangements established under the Act, their views regarding land and subsistence, all the questions of native land and governance that that you hear about in Alaska today, and we are going to be spending the rest of this year in the villages obtaining the views of those people. This overview meeting, this series of overview hearings, roundtable discussions, is designed in a sense to provide an intellectual framework for those meetings in the villages. If nothing else, to educate me on some of the questions that have to be considered. So the Commission is taking the broadest view of its terms of reference. We're looking at ANCSA in the very broadest context, ANCSA being the acronym for the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And next year I will write a report based on what people in the villages have said. And the report will be written for Alaska Natives to make use of in planning the directions they intend to take in the years leading to 1991 and beyond. I hope it will as well be useful to Native Americans in the lower 48 and to indigenous peoples in other countries, and indeed we expect that next week at our roundtable discussions, there will be Native leaders and scholars from Canada, Greenland, Australia, Norway, and perhaps other countries as well, to discuss the ways in which they have been grappling with land claims and the issue of native self-government in those other jurisdictions. Today, we have with us to give the opening paper, Professor Joseph Jorgensen, who is a professor of history and anthropology at the University of California, Irvine campus. He is author of The Sundance Religion and is well known, particularly in the West and the Southwest. David Case, who is special counsel to this commission and teaches law at Fairbanks, and is the author of, I think, the most important work on native rights here in Alaska, will be joining us this afternoon. He is a law professor in the Native Studies program at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. Also joining us, but not until tomorrow morning, will be Professor Ted Chamberlain of the University of Toronto, who wrote The Harrowing of Eden, a minor classic on white native interaction in North America since the time of Columbus. I think as well tomorrow, Browning Pipestem will be joining us. He is an Indian attorney from Oklahoma with a great knowledge of Indian history and law, and is co-author of the Bureau of Indian Affairs Indian Preference Act. With us today as well is Mr. Tito Naranjo, professor of psychology and social services, Highlands University, New Mexico, and past president of the Santa Clara Pueblo Tribal Council. Alma Upixen is with us today. She is an Inupiat law school graduate, currently working with the Native American Rights Fund in Boulder, Colorado. And as well, Mr. Kim Jerome Gottschalk, an attorney at law with the Native American Rights Fund, is here as well and has joined us at the round table. We are pleased to have Tim Coulter with us, who is executive director of the Indian Law Resource Center at Washington, D.C., and has written extensively on questions bearing on Indian land and governance. We are also very pleased to have with us Ada Deer, who is who was organizer and representative of the Menominee Indians throughout the period of restoration. Their situation is well known to us all. Ada Deer directed the Upward Bound program at the University of Wisconsin, chaired the Menominee Restoration Committee, and now teaches at the University of Wisconsin at Madison after serving as legislative liaison for the Native American Rights Fund in Washington, D.C. Tom Hawkins should be here. I'm sure he will be here. He is director of the Division of Land and Water, the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, and former adjudicator of land allotments at the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, and formerly on the staff of the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission. And he also served for a number of years in the early 70s as general manager of one of the largest village corporations, the Dillingham Village Corporation here in Alaska. We are fortunate to have with us Mr. Russell Jim, who has served as a councilman of the Yakima Nation in the state of Washington, and has served as well as area vice president of NCAI, the National Congress of American Indians. We have with us Ralph Johnson, who is a professor of law at the University of Washington, and one of the authors of the 1982 revision of Felix Cohen's well-known classic Handbook of Federal Indian Law, which I may say is a book used not only in the United States, but in Canada and in many other countries. We have with us as well Ralph Lerner, who is a professor of political philosophy from the University of Chicago and author of Reds and Whites, Rights and Wrongs. Now, there's a title for you. To provide a continuing Alaskan presence through this overview, We have invited the following persons to be present. Patty Ginsburg is here from the Alaska Federation of Natives, and in addition, we have invited the United Tribes of Alaska to have a representative at the table, and I don't see one at the moment, but Sheldon Ketchetag, the Vice President, told me yesterday that they would be sending a representative. And Daley Sambo has been invited also to be present at the table. She is a Special Assistant to the President of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference. Now, might I just tell you that we have a transcript made of all that is said here, and so we are using the audio equipment, and Jim Sykes and Tim Buckley are operating that machinery, and it means that from time to time, when you are speaking, you will understand if I intervene and just state your name so that on the audio it comes across, and if you can remember yourselves to give your name as we proceed. If I have failed to do so, if you would do that yourself, that would be helpful. All of the proceedings are being televised. I'm being long-winded about this, but we're going to be here all week, so I'll stop talking sooner or later. All of the proceedings are being televised by Learn Alaska, which is the Bush television network, which is run under state auspices, by the independent public television network, and by the North Slope Borough television network. And they are making tapes or movies or something of all of this, and then they will be making programs out of the material. That's my understanding of what they're up to. I think that's as far as I need to go now. Might I now take some few minutes of your time in an attempt to summarize what we learned last week, so that those of you who were not here will get some idea, and I cannot, of course, do justice to all that was said last week, but some of you will get some idea of the thrust of the discussions last week. Last week we considered the spirit of ANCSA, that is, what was it that Native leaders and the Native people of Alaska were trying to achieve at the time of the settlement of land claims 12 years ago, and what was Congress trying to achieve? Papers were given by Ann Fina Reardon, an anthropologist who teaches here at the University of Alaska, and by Walter Parker, an historian and economist who has joined us again this week. And we had a discussion in which, for instance, Don Wright, who was president of the Alaska Federation of Natives at the time of ANCSA, and Francis Degnan, who was secretary of the Federation at the time, took part. So did many other Native leaders who had participated in the land claim movements at the time, including Mr. Alfred Starr, who is here with us again today, and who told us last week of the origins of land claims in this state many, many years ago. In addition, we had some of the representatives of the corporations today, Mr. Charles Johnson, president of Bering Straits Corporation and president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, participated. So also did Mr. Byron Malott, president of Sea Alaska, which is, I think, the largest of the regional Native corporations. Frank Peterson, president of one of the village corporations, joined us. And as well, we were joined by Professor Doug Jones of Ohio State, who was at the time legislative assistant to can anybody help me out? Senator Mike Gravel of Alaska. Guy Martin, who was legislative assistant to Congressman Nick Begich from Alaska. Mr. William Van Ness, a Washington attorney who was at the time an assistant to Senator Jackson, Senator Henry Jackson, and we also had with us John Havlicek of Anchorage, who was at the time Attorney General of Alaska in the Egan administration. Having given you the cast of characters, let me tell you what, in as brief a compass as I can, they said. Native leaders and others spoke of the history of the land claims movement here in Alaska. They said that it was gathering momentum in the 1960s, and in that decade, the idea of a legislative settlement began to emerge. The notion of seeking justice through the U.S. Indian Claims Commission gradually faded. The time that it took the Tlingit and Haidas to achieve their settlement through the courts led in one way or another to a feeling that a legislative settlement was to be preferred. The discovery of oil at Prudhoe Bay in 1968, of course, gave great impetus to the idea of a legislative settlement of land claims in Alaska, and at that time a settlement began to take shape. Now, Ann Phenop Reardon went through the testimony given by Alaska Natives at congressional subcommittee hearings that were held in Alaska at the time, and her paper discusses the objectives as Alaska Natives perceived them in pursuing a land claim settlement. And she listed, and these were gleaned from the testimony, continuity in use and occupation of the land, two, the importance of cash compensation in order to facilitate economic development, three, resolution of past social ills and full participation in the future, four, the achievement of self-sufficiency and self-determination, and five, continuity and cultural integrity. And Ann Reardon pointed out that that having listened to the discussion all of last week, she realized that that most of those themes were still in the forefront of the minds of spokesmen for Alaska Natives today, even though enhanced public expenditures, federal and state, for housing and health and education had greatly improved the condition of Alaska Natives measured by those usual statistical indices. The leaders of the land claims movement went to Washington, D.C. in the late 60s and early 70s, and they told us how they perceived the settlement that was enacted by Congress. They regarded it as a real estate transaction, a means of securing as much land for Alaska Natives as they could, of ensuring that land for subsistence was obtained in maximum measure, of ensuring that cash was provided to enable economic development to be undertaken by Alaska Natives. They felt that the question of political institutions, of sovereignty, was one that was not addressed and not intended to be addressed. Those who spoke for the Congress, that is Professor Jones, Mr. Van Ness, and Mr. Guy Martin, they told us that Senator Jackson and Congressman Aspinall and other congressmen had an agenda that was somewhat different from that of the native leaders. They regarded ANCSA as a means of ensuring that construction of the proposed oil pipeline, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, would not be impeded. But at the same time, they regarded ANCSA as a means, and Professor Jones and Mr. Van Ness were quite explicit about this, a means of bringing Alaska Natives into the mainstream of American capitalism. Professor Jones referred to the act as social engineering. He said that it was intended to alter cultural attitudes. Mr. Havelock, though he did not approve of this, made the oft-noted comparison between the Dawes Act and its attempt to turn Indians in the lower 48 into farmers, and ANCSA as the modern-day counterpart seeking to turn Alaska Natives into businessmen. It was, at any rate, in this way that the corporate model was chosen. Senator Jackson and Chairman Aspinall, the two principal congressional figures in the development and passage of ANCSA, were not willing, we were told, to see the reservation system extended to Alaska. There were some reservations in Alaska, but the reservation system had not been extended in any considerable measure to this state. Alaska Native leaders that were themselves not at all convinced that the reservation system was suited to Alaska. Their experience with IRAs was limited. There were a number of them in Alaska, but to a great extent they were under the influence of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So that Alaska Native leaders did not urge that there be any other vehicle. A minority urged that the land and money that were to be received under the settlement should go to traditional councils or to the IRAs, but it is clear that they were definitely a minority. And as well, we were told that Alaska Native leaders were advised that a plea that IRAs should be the vehicle for receiving the settlement lands and money would not be well received by Congress. So, for one reason or another, if they did not initiate the idea of adopting the corporate mode, Alaska Native leaders certainly concurred in it. And under this arrangement, as you know, 12 regional corporations, a 13th based in Seattle, representing those Alaska Natives not connected with any region, 12 regional corporations were established, 200 village corporations were established. They are all for-profit corporations. Each Alaska Native enrolled under the Act holds 100 shares in his village corporation and 100 shares in his regional corporation. 44 million acres received under the Act. I put to one side the question, well, this, as many Native leaders said to us last week, this was all our land. You know, we weren't given something. It was already ours. So I'm using this word received in the hope that it's regarded as neutral. The 44 million acres were received by the corporations, and land selections were made by both the regional corporations and the village corporations. But the village corporations hold surface rights only. All subsurface rights to land held by the native corporations is held by the regional corporations. That is, they hold the subsurface rights to the lands that they, as regional corporations, hold. They also hold the subsurface rights to the lands held by village corporations. $962.5 million were also received by the corporations, and this money was has been used for economic development of one kind or another. I think there was a limited per capita distribution, and there have been some dividends paid by some of the corporations from time to time. Now, I should say that at the two village meetings that we have already held, at Amonac and Tununuk, held last month, two villages on the coast of the Bering Sea, We heard from Alaska Natives who live in the villages about the settlement, and in those two villages, I only mention this because you may have read something about our visits to those villages. I don't know whether their views are representative or not, but the villages there expressed the view, I think it was widely held, that they had seen little or nothing in terms of money under the Act. As local shareholders, they had received little or nothing in the way of dividends. They had complaints about the fact that the regional corporation held subsurface resources that were no longer accessible to them on the one hand, or might on the other hand be exploited without their consent or even in some cases their knowledge. On the other hand, I think it should be said, and I had something I was going to read to you here, that this Act is in many ways a landmark achievement. It was the means, it has been the means, of holding and consolidating ancestral lands for 12 years now, and it has been the means for the corporations, the native corporations, to acquire economic power and thereby political influence in Alaska. In terms of their impact on the Alaskan economy, there was an article last weekend on Sunday, March 4th, 1984, in the Anchorage Times, written by Mr. Roy M. Hundorf, president of Cook Inlet Regional Corporation. This is one of the native regional corporations. And might I just read a few passages, because I think this is a view that many in Alaska, certainly many in the business community, hold. Mr. Hundorf says, over the past 12 years, native corporations have quietly assumed a major role in the economy of our state. And then he discusses the achievements of the corporations. And I think it's fair to say he's talking chiefly about the 12 regional corporations. First, what has occurred in the period following 1971 is the transfer of 44 million acres out of government hands into private ownership. Prior to 1971, less than 1% of Alaska's land was in private ownership. When land conveyances have been completed to the native corporations, approximately 12% of Alaska's land will be in private hands. The 44 million acres received by the native people represents about, I think, 10% of the land in Alaska. From the perspective of resource development, this was a particularly important change. The marketplace of opportunity for mineral development, timber, oil, and gas development, and for other uses has changed tremendously as a consequence. Evidence of this is the quantity of land that native corporations have been able to commit for development over the past 10 years. For example, while 70% of the entitlement of the native corporations has been conveyed, that is, about 70% of the land they are to receive has been formally patented, about half of that land, or about 15 million acres, has been committed to resource development, to resource exploration and development. He goes on, these development agreements on native lands have in turn caused more than $750 million to be spent on exploration and development activities over the past 6 years, dollars which might not have otherwise been spent in the state's economy. Native corporations have also been a source of investment capital in our state, investing most of the nearly $1 billion, that is the $962.5 million received under the settlement in 1971, investing most of the nearly $1 billion in proceeds from the settlement in various businesses in all sectors of the state's economy. The native corporations have recognized that their destiny is tightly bound to Alaska, and as a consequence, they have taken an interest in the basic industries of the state, industries that are important for the economic health of the native community and the state as a whole. Commercial fishing, cannery operations, air travel, construction, oil and gas, minerals, coal, timber, and industry support service businesses have all benefited from substantial investments from native corporations. Finally, native corporations have served as a balance in the economy and politics of the state, limiting the influence of those who would lock up the state and those who would plunder it. The native corporations also have been an effective voice for responsible legislation in Washington. For example, during a time when environmental groups were pitted against development interests almost to the point of stalemate, It was often the native corporations who were able to establish reasonable approaches as the basis for coalitions that could command legislative approval. Well, I won't read the whole of the article, but that, I think, is a view widely held among businessmen in Alaska and perhaps as well among corporate leaders in the native corporations. I mention it because it is a view that has not so far been found its counterpart in the villages. Their feeling thus far, at least, appears to be that the settlement has not brought employment to the villages and that indeed it has raised questions about the continuance of native control over the land. In the late 1960s, to Alaska Natives, it is apparent that the most important concern they had was to preserve and protect their ancestral lands. And this, on the basis of the meetings held in Amonik and Tununuk, is still today their most important concern. But as Byron Malott told us last week, he is the president of Sea Alaska Corporation, he said, it is not their land. He said, it belongs to the corporations. It is an economic asset held by an institution dedicated to profit-making ventures. And Mr. Malott acknowledged the dilemma that that presents for people like himself who understand that the concern of people at the local level, the village level, is the preservation of the land, subsistence, and cultural integrity. Mr. Malott pointed out that the corporations, though for 12 years they have had the power to sell the land, have not divested themselves of the land or any significant portion of it. But he did say that there is nothing to stop the corporations from selling the land. And it should be noted that the land can, in any event, be sold to pay corporate debts or to satisfy creditors on a bankruptcy. And might I just return to Mr. Malott's testimony, because he indicated the dilemma that the corporate mode of holding the land presents. He pointed out that for the villages, in many, many of them in Alaska, subsistence is their primary concern. It is an activity not likely to generate income, and the land regarded as an economic asset by the corporations may then be required to be dedicated to purposes inconsistent with subsistence activities. And I think all of us who were here will remember how Mr. Malott put that dilemma quite frankly and starkly to us. Now, these corporations, if I may move on, these corporations are shareholder corporations, not membership corporations. As I understand the Indian Reorganization Act, corporations under that act are membership corporations. These are shareholder corporations, and only those Alaska Natives alive when the Act came into force in 1971 are entitled to be enrolled as shareholders. So all Native children born since 1971 in Alaska have no right to be enrolled as shareholders, though they may acquire shares by inheritance. It is evident that this feature of the settlement, which leaves their children without any legal interest, direct or indirect, in their ancestral lands, without any right to participate in the settlement, is deeply disturbing to Alaska Natives. That is perhaps the most emphatic note in the testimony heard thus far. In Amonik, for instance, there are about 200 children in the elementary school and the high school. Those over 12 years of age have shares in the corporations. Those under 12 years of age do not. So of the 200 children in these two schools at this village of Amonik, which has about 500 or 600 people, of the 200 children, approximately 100 are shareholders and 100 are not. And families, too, of course, see this division between children who are shareholders and those who are not. A brother, 12 years of age, may hold shares. His sister, a year younger at 11, does not. And these are, this is a state of affairs that seems clearly to be deeply disturbing to Alaska Natives. Now, Congress contemplated the possibility, according to Professor Jones, Congress contemplated the possibility of these corporations and the lands and other assets they hold passing from Native control to non-Native control. Professor Jones didn't say this was intended, but he said it was a possibility they contemplated, and the machinery of the Act, if unchanged, could conceivably lead to such an outcome. It was provided in ANCSA that the shares in the corporations could not be transferred for 20 years, that is, until 1991. Congress intended that if these are to be corporations in every sense, the shares must be tradable on the open market, and the shares do become tradable on the open market in 1991. Furthermore, the land held by the corporations, as long as it remains undeveloped, is not subject to state property taxes, but 20 years after conveyance, in 1991 and thereafter, the land, whether developed or undeveloped, whether devoted to subsistence or to other economic activities, becomes subject to taxation. Now, by one means or another then, unless there are changes made, the corporations and the land may conceivably be lost to Alaska Natives. And this is a palpable fear among Alaska Natives, certainly at the meetings that we have held thus far. That fear has been expressed time and again. And every indication appears to be that Alaska Natives do not want that to happen, even if it means restrictions are placed on their right, exercisable in 1991, to sell the shares for money or money's worth. Now, the corporations are economic institutions, but they have had to serve, in a sense, as political institutions as well, because no political institutions were set up under the Claims Act. Indeed, Native leaders say that the issue of political autonomy was not addressed by the Act. But now, the question of political autonomy has become an issue in Alaska. Many Native people are urging that the IRAs should be strengthened or that traditional councils should be strengthened. Some urge that the corporations should transfer the lands they hold to the IRAs to ensure that the land, the ancestral land of Alaska Natives, remains in Native hands, even if the corporations do not. And Mr. Malott, in his testimony last week, himself urged that the ancestral lands of Alaska Natives be transferred out of the hands of the corporations into institutions that would be perpetually under control of Alaska Natives. So last week there was much discussion about the advantages and disadvantages of IRAs. In other words, people were looking for some other vehicle. So they started to talk last week about IRAs and about the reservation system. And as far as I can tell, for the first time in 100 years, the Native leaders from Alaska had something good to say about the reservation system. And so it seemed to us entirely appropriate that we should have brought all of you together here this week, given the outcome of the discussion last week. I had urged that we should ask all of you to tell us about your own experience with IRAs, the reservation system, by what means Native Americans in the lower 48 had struggled with the question of holding and managing their lands, how and with what success they had struggled with issues of self-rule and self-government, how they had rationalized relations with the federal government and the states. All of these questions have arisen here, perhaps in a different context from that in which you are used to them in the lower 48. But the outcome of the discussion last week seemed to me to bring us on a path that in many ways is a path of convergence with the very concerns that I believe you have in the lower 48. There is, it seems to me, a worldwide movement by indigenous peoples for self-sufficiency and self-determination, and we hope that having had this very capsule a glimpse of how that struggle is developing in Alaska, we hope that you will tell us in the very broadest sense how that struggle is being waged in the lower 48. Here in Alaska, people are talking about various ways of moving towards a greater measure of self-determination. Last week here at the Overview, Charles Johnson, who is president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, expressed the desire of Alaska Natives not to be just citizens of the United States of America, but to be recognized as Native people as well, a distinct people in America with their own institutions. Mr. Johnson felt that the corporations here in Alaska were perhaps a sufficient expression of that desire for Native institutions. On the other hand, Willie Goodwin, Jr., president of the United Tribes of Alaska, has, not here, but his views are well known, has taken the view that those institutions must be political, that is, have lawmaking authority, authority derived from the limited sovereignty that tribal governments possess as domestic dependent nations. Many non-natives in the state of Alaska oppose such political institutions for Alaska Natives. They believe that Alaska Natives should, as citizens of Alaska, participate in state chartered city and borough governments as other citizens do, and that these state institutions are sufficient for Alaska Natives. We found in Tununik, where they have a city government chartered by the state, they also have a traditional IRA council, Mr. Mike Albert, the president of the village IRA council, said, "We have two governments in this village, a city government chartered by the state, a traditional IRA government, and one of them must go." And that puts the issue in what might be called a pretty blunt language. And Mr. Albert made it clear which one of them he thought should go and which should stay. In any event, arguments about self-rule and sovereignty have arisen here in Alaska, and they seem to be intertwined with these 1991 issues. At any rate, they may have been given here, I think they have been given a special kind of urgency by reason of the felt necessity by Native people here in Alaska to make provision to avoid the consequences that, as the Act now stands, lie in wait in 1991. Sale of shares, taxation of land, the possibility of loss of control of the corporations and of the land held by the corporations, and virtually all ancestral Native land is held by the corporations. I hope that you will consider this in the broadest perspective, that you will feel free to look at the broad moral and ethical aspects of these matters from the perspective of relations between the dominant society and indigenous people, from the perspective of the conflict, if that's the right word, between institutions established by Europeans on this continent and the persistence of Native culture and Native institutions. And you might consider how these considerations bear equally on Native Americans in the lower 48, and if you think they do, on Alaska Natives as well. If you see similarities in the issues that Alaska Natives are grappling with and those that Native Americans in the lower 48 are grappling with, I hope you would make that clear to us. The only other thing I want to say is that this roundtable, these 3 weeks of roundtable discussions, are sponsored not only by this commission, the Alaska Native Review Commission, but as well by the Humanities Forum of the State of Alaska, whose chairman, Chris Cook, he was recently chairman, and whose new chairman, Ron Scollin, and the executive director, Gary Holtas, have worked closely with the commission in arranging these overview meetings. And indeed, without the commission's, without the assistance of the Humanities Forum, these roundtable discussions would not be taking place. I can't resist saying that the long a written document you received describing the commission, the project description, I think it's called, was prepared for the Humanities Forum, and that's why it refers to broad humanitarian considerations. And I, if I may say so, think that it is an excellent way of introducing the discussion, and I think those broad moral and ethical considerations are appropriate to be considered. It was, I think, if I may be forgiven for saying so, notable last week that those who came here from Washington, D.C., two of the three of them suggested that references to de Tocqueville and to Las Casas and to the ancient origin of these questions going back to the Spanish conquest were nice, but not the sort of thing that, you know, really practical men and women in 1984 could get their teeth into, and that we had to look instead at the Act, specific changes, talk to the power brokers in Washington, D.C., and get on with it. Well, I was grateful to them for expressing that view, but I do hope you won't, that you'll feel free to range widely over history and economics and literature and race relations and whatever else comes into your head. Well, forgive me for that long-winded introduction, but I did want to acquaint you with, you know, the story thus far. And here we are.